Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we'll talk about U visa applicants, victims of crime who are being deported as they apply for a visa to stay in the country.
And what's behind the Valley's love of holiday lights?
But first, Phoenix Pride is facing a major budget deficit to the tune of $350,000. This after they saw pretty significant losses at this year's annual Pride Festival in attendance and sponsorships, and as they're seeing donor support drop significantly. And they're not the only Pride organization across the country that's facing these challenges. In August, Boise Pride had a $250,000 deficit a month before their festival. And in May, NYC Pride saw a $750,000 shortfall because of corporate sponsors pulling back. It all comes as the Trump administration has attacked diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives across the country, and many companies have dropped their programs in response. And that's hit organizations like Pride hard, according to our first guest this morning. Daniel Ekstrom is the president of Phoenix Pride's Volunteer Board of Directors. I spoke with him more about it earlier this morning.
Well, you know, when we started with our new budget in the beginning of January of 2025, you know, we as a board and as a staff really tried to cut as much as we could because we knew that the climate of things in the country was going to shift. So, you know, we did a 22% cut to our annual budget, which a majority of our budget is our festival. So right off the top, we did a 22% cut on that. But then, you know, after everything was all said and done and after our festival was complete, you know, we found that we had a dip in admissions, about a 38% loss, a 50% loss in our beverage sales, probably around a 30% loss in our festival sponsorships, mm-hmm. and about a 36% loss in our parade sponsorship. So that's kind of what led us to what we're facing currently.
Wow. So, okay. I mean, part of this, right, is that things cost more. The cost of putting on a festival is probably more expensive than it used to be. But it also sounds like it's because of the kind of current environment. You've heard this from a lot of folks. Like you mentioned in your Facebook post about this, DEI cuts and attacks by the Trump administration. What do you think that kind of current environment means when it comes to these losses?
Yeah, you know, and you're right. I think, and really, it's come all the way since COVID, the increase in costs. But this year, is, you know, particularly, we found it very, very difficult to maintain some of the sponsors that we had previously, and that was, you know, because of things like corporations cutting their DEI initiatives, and just the current political climate overall, you know, meant that maybe people didn't feel safe to want to go out and celebrate something like Pride. And so we've really seen a lot of different reasons why this is kind of where we're at right now.
Hmm. You also mentioned loss of sponsorships, donors, things like that. Have you heard from, had conversations with donors or companies that used to support Pride and don't anymore?
You know, we reach out to everybody that has previously sponsored, and, you know, we try to reach out multiple times if we don't get a response. But, you know, we also do our due diligence and looking to see, you know, what type of initiatives they support and what type of initiatives maybe they didn't support. And so we do reach out and we do ask, but we don't necessarily get back responses to some of those questions. But, you know, it definitely is something that we were, you know, afraid of, and we were hoping that it wasn't going to happen, but, you know, it really did, because it led into, you know, to where we're at now, you know, with the 30% loss in our sponsorship just for our festival. And then you add the percent loss that we did for our parade sponsorships as well, and that's over 60%.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Let's back up for a minute, Daniel, and just talk about what Pride is and kind of why it matters to the queer community, right? Like, I mean, there's a big history here. It's kind of an important organization in the history of LGBTQ plus rights. I mean, talk a little bit about that and kind of the role that Pride has had in the community for so long.
Yeah, our Pride was founded in 1981, and you know, we have been part of the community since then. And I think in the early 80s, it was a very different climate and a very different landscape to what is now in 2025. Mm-hmm. But I think the circle rounds often, and now we're facing, you know, a lot of similar struggles that we did in the early 80s. And so I think that Phoenix Pride and just Pride in general, whether it's in our own community or in some other community somewhere else, it really is a beacon of hope for people. I think, you know, for people that are recently coming out, or for people that maybe have kids that are coming out, mm-hmm. or family members that are coming out, it's someplace that they can go and celebrate and they can be themselves. We want to continue that, and we want to be able to be that within our community, because I feel it's very important. And it doesn't matter if it's, you know, 2025 or 2045, Pride is always going to be needed, because there are always going to be people out there that need support, that maybe their family aren't giving them, or maybe their friends aren't giving them, but something that we can give them.
Hmm. So this massive budget shortfall you're facing, I mean, what impact will it have on the organization going forward? You do more than put on festivals, we should say. You give out grants and scholarships, funds, things like that.
Right. So one of the major things that is facing is, you know, we won't be able to give out our partnership grants this year. Luckily, we will be able to continue to give out our scholarships, because we do that through the Miss and Mr. and Mix Phoenix Pride pageant that we have yearly. And those contestants raise money for our scholarship programs. But, you know, things like our grants, we won't be able to do this year, you know. And what we wanted to do when we put out this statement is we also put out a survey to the community to ask what we could do differently and what we can do to maybe help move this organization forward. And, you know, we've gotten a lot of responses, and we are, as an organization, going to look at all of that in depth to hopefully help us, you know, maneuver into a new era of what Pride looks like.
Right. So what might that look like? What did you hear from folks, and where do you think it could take you?
You know, I think one of the major things that we keep seeing is going back to a grassroots effort. And really, that's what Pride started as, you know, grassroots efforts of people that were tired and that were fed up with how they were treated. And it seems like that seems to be an underlying theme of what people want Pride to go back to, which is something that is definitely needed in our current state of our country. And so, you know, we're going to be taking a look at how we can do that, how we can bring different groups of people together.
Let me ask you lastly, Daniel, just like how you feel about all this, right? Like, you're not the only Pride organization in the country that's facing shortfalls like this, that's facing sponsorship cuts and donors cuts because of maybe this current administration, the current environment, like you mentioned. Is it still important today, or maybe even more important today, you think?
Absolutely. I think now more than ever, Pride is important, because we are seeing a lot of things that are trying to stifle our Pride, are trying to, you know, cast doubt and cast shadows over who we are as an LGBTQ plus community. And I think it is very important to continue to support organizations like Pride. There's a lot of different organizations throughout our community that do great work for the LGBT community. And I think that if the community wants these organizations to flourish, you know, we all need to kind of stand together and figure out how we move forward.
Okay, we'll leave it there for now. Daniel Ekstrom, president of the Phoenix Pride Volunteer Board of Directors, joining us. Daniel, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Laura, and I appreciate it.
One of the more visible impacts for a lot of Americans during the federal government shutdown was flights being canceled. And one of the main reasons that happened was a lack of air traffic controllers. Those federal employees were required to work without pay for the duration of the 43-day shutdown. Some called in sick and had to take other jobs to make ends meet during that time. But not all air traffic controllers were affected like that. Some are not federal employees, but instead work for one of four companies that staffs towers across the country, including at Mesa Gateway, Flagstaff, and Chandler airports. With me to talk more about this is Kyle Wilkerson, Program Coordinator for Air Traffic Control at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott. And Kyle, what's the difference between an air traffic controller who goes through the FAA training and one who goes through a different one?
Yeah, so actually there's not very many differences between the two. There are private companies that operate in the United States and satisfy those federal contract tower obligations. And there's actually the majority of the towers across the country are covered by federal contract towers. There's actually, more than 50% of them are operated via private companies.
So do these tend to be smaller airports? I just wonder, when during the, for example, the federal government shutdown and air traffic controllers, of course, were not getting paid. And we heard so much about how they weren't showing up to work and had to, get other jobs to make ends meet and pay their bills, that air traffic slowed down considerably. Was that because the FAA workers tend to be more at large commercial airports as opposed to smaller ones?
That's correct. So these towers, these federal contract towers through the FCT program, are generally smaller facilities or smaller towers across the country. And so when you're talking about those really large, heavy hitter airports such as San Francisco or Phoenix, those are federal. Those are under the FAA. And so that's where you're seeing the controllers that were impacted heavily by the federal shutdown.
Is that on purpose or is that just kind of the way it's worked out?
It's just the way it's worked out. Not necessarily on purpose per se, but as these companies pick up more contracts, you're going to see that number start to tick up of how many facilities are managed by federal contracts. Mesa Gateway is a good example. That's a pretty decent sized airport. Mm-hmm. And so there are some larger airports that are picked up by federal contracts.
Okay, so I want to ask you about that. I mean, I'm curious if you see a future in which more air traffic controllers are not working directly for the FAA. It sounds like you do see a future like that.
I think that number is going to ebb and flow as time goes on. They're actively adding, and I say they, the FAA is actively accepting applications and adding federal contract towers to the program. And so air traffic control facilities as well as airports aren't something that you see built all the time or on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of hoops you got to jump through to get one of these up and running. And so it's naturally easier to see a federal facility, a federal tower transition to a contract facility. So that's why you'd see that number shift. And honestly, that's why we have a greater percentage, over 50% of the towers across the country are managed by these private companies. So I can't definitively say that it's going to transition that way and we're going to see more private operators versus federal. That number, like I said, is just going to shift.
Are there advantages and disadvantages to the air traffic system of either FAA air traffic controllers or contract air traffic controllers?
Ultimately, no. That is a pretty subjective question, mainly just because it just kind of depends on how the businesses are run. Because they're private companies, they may have different policies on how they manage their folks, their employees. And so you're going to find with any company, right, the culture is a big deal and culture changes per company. And so you can have somebody that rolls into one company or works for somebody for a long period of time and they absolutely love it. And then they might shift over to a different company and not like that culture.
But I guess one thing we should clarify is for those contract air traffic controllers, they all got paid during the shutdown, right? Whereas the FAA employees did not.
Yeah, correct. And to be very clear about it as well, these federal contract towers are held to the same standard as FAA employees and FAA towers. So there's actually no difference in the operation of aircraft as they're transitioning across airspaces or departing from a particular airfield. Whether that is a federal contract tower or an FAA tower, they follow all the same rules. And to be a controller in a contract tower, you also have to pass the same exact training that federal controllers do as well.
Right. Whose decision is it whether or not a particular airport's tower is going to be staffed by FAA or contract employees?
It's usually a combination of both the city as well as the company that wants to apply. Like I said, there's about four companies that are in the industry at the present moment in the United States, and they may be looking at traffic flow, whether there's a cost benefit analysis completed, and they'll determine whether it financially makes sense for the FAA to start providing that service through the federal contract program and whether it's going to be lucrative enough for that particular company. So it really is a joint effort between the city, between the company that's going to be looking at placing their folks there, their facility there. And obviously the FAA is heavily involved because obviously everything in the United States airspace, the national airspace, is managed by them.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like one of the considerations, not the only one, but one of them is it more or less expensive for the FAA to staff a tower on its own or to hire a company to have its contract workers come and do it?
Precisely. Yes.
Understanding that, as you say, there are different companies that have different, you know, different cultures and different, not standards, but sort of different ways of doing things to some extent. I'm wondering if the pay is generally similar between working for one of the private companies and working directly for the FAA.
The pay is generally similar. You're gonna see that the majority of the controllers that are working for federal contract towers, because they're working at smaller facilities, they're not dealing with higher traffic counts. And so you're going to see a reduction in pay just simply because of that, because their responsibilities, I don't want to say are less important in any way, but because the traffic count drops.
Do you foresee a time when there will be enough air traffic controllers to really fully staff the towers across this country the way they ought to be staffed?
I think without, you know, avoiding a heavily political answer of, yep, it eventually could get there. I think it really could. And mainly because the changes that I've seen and the positive strides that we've actively seen in just the last 3 to 4 years in air traffic control training, as well as the processes to get people into the industry, it has changed drastically in really, really good ways. And honestly, that was some changes that I did not anticipate to see in my lifetime. These changes aren't, again, something that's going to happen overnight. We do have to understand that it takes training, it takes time to get people through that training, and we have to hold people to a very high standard. And so it's not going to be an overnight fix, but I do actively believe that we're going to be eventually fixing that. You know, this is a very evolving industry and things are changing in the right direction.
Hmm. Are you seeing students at Embry-Riddle who are interested in a career in air traffic controlling, whereas maybe before you didn't?
Absolutely. The publicity that we've received, and I don't say we as the industry or the university, but the publicity that we have seen in air traffic control in general is really drawing a lot of attention from up and coming potential candidates. You know, we have a lot of students that come in here and they didn't even think about air traffic control until they saw in the news that they need controllers in the industry right now. And that piqued their interest. They look at the industry, they look at the neat things that air traffic controllers do on a day-to-day basis. And it just piques their interest. And all of a sudden that's what they want to do and start looking into. So yes, we are actively seeing a lot of people really show a lot of interest in air traffic control.
Kyle Wilkerson is the program coordinator for air traffic control at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a group of kids recently ended up in the hospital with the same bacterial infection, doctors think, and they may have gotten it all from the same place.
We went to the ER Saturday morning, and then it just kind of got worse from there.
Was there E. coli at the State Fair's petting zoo?
But first, as the Trump administration's aggressive deportations continue, one group is being targeted that has some law enforcement and prosecutors concerned: U visa applicants. U visas are specifically for victims of crime in the U.S. They're often used for people who have information about criminal activity that could be useful for investigators or prosecutors. A common example is a victim of sex trafficking. Prosecutors or law enforcement investigators might try to get them a U visa so they can testify against their traffickers. But now there are reports that these applicants are being deported or detained before they can get that visa, and that could interfere with investigations and prosecutions. A statement from the Law Enforcement Immigration Task Force, including Tucson Police Chief Chad Kazmar, says targeting U visa applicants for deportation could create a damaging chilling effect and discourage crime victims from coming forward. Kristen Fitzharris is director of litigation and advocacy at Southern Arizona Legal Aid. She works with people who are trying to get U visas. She told me they're already seeing fewer people willing to apply for them.
It can take 8 to 10 years to receive adjudication of that U visa application after you filed it.
Yeah.
However, in maybe about 5 years or so, a lot of people who have a strong case can get what's called a bona fide determination. And that includes the legal ability to work and, importantly, protection from deportation or removal, as we call it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is called deferred action. And that's usually very helpful to people as they're waiting in this incredibly long, decades-long process.
Yeah. So they're not supposed to be deported if they're in this process, it sounds like.
Yes, when they have received that deferred action. After that, though, they are supposed to not be able to be removed. And for the most part, we are seeing that they aren't. However, they can still be put into immigration detention. Mm. And it's been very hard recently to get people out, even though they have deferred action. They just sit in detention for a long time.
Even if they're in the process of helping assist in a prosecution like this.
Yeah, that's correct.
Wow. So I want to talk about the implications of that in a minute. But first, tell us, like, what kinds of crimes do you often see U visa applications come out of?
Well, for us, the majority of our clients for U visas are victims of domestic violence, family violence, sexual assault. They can be a victim of trafficking, but that's not the only crimes. There's a large list, which does include blackmail or extortion or felonious assault. So it could be an assault from someone who's you're not related to. So it is quite broad, but not every crime in the book.
Right. So, I mean, that's tough, right? Like, do you often, it sounds like, have U visa applicants in this very long process who maybe wouldn't want to testify otherwise? Like, they're the victim of a domestic violence case. Those people are often don't want to prosecute, things like that. Like, is this a touchy, it sounds like?
Yes. Well, sexual assault and prostitution are some of the crimes that can be eligible. Mm. And that can be very difficult for people to want to come forward. And so the congressional intent behind this offering this visa when it was enacted in 2000 was to encourage people to come forward and to be helpful in the investigation and the prosecution and to be witnesses. And it would also give them some way of remaining in the United States so that they could be safe.
It also really helps law enforcement, right? Or prosecutors who are trying to carry out these cases as well, because they're trying to put these people behind bars.
Yeah, that's correct. It helps when people feel comfortable or at least aren't too scared to report crimes that are occurring. It helps them capture and prosecute the people who really are perpetrating crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really helps our judicial system out a lot to have this visa. And we work closely with a lot of law enforcement and with prosecutors all around Southern Arizona.
Yeah, yeah. So law enforcement is starting to voice concerns about U visa applicants because they're seeing reports that they are being swept up in these immigration raids and deported in some cases. It sounds like from your point of view, you are seeing a little bit of that, but more often these people getting put into detention and then being basically inaccessible to the process.
Well, that's true. But what we saw immediately in January 31st of this year was that a victim-centered approach memo, which was a formal procedure, was rescinded. Mm-hmm. So victims used to be a low priority for removal, and there used to be a lot more prosecutorial discretion for victims of crime. And so when that was rescinded, our U visa applicants have been swept up along with a lot of other immigrants or non-immigrants, as they're called, in this heightened enforcement. There are mass recalendarings of cases that were administratively closed. Mm. And as we were talking about, it can take decades to get this U visa. So people did have their removal cases, their deportation cases closed, you know, sitting on ice while they were allowed to go through this process and wait for this visa because they were a low priority for removal.
Right.
And that's just not the case anymore. And so people are having their cases proceed quickly and with no respect for the amount of time it takes USCIS to adjudicate these applications, and probably not a lot of consideration as to the effect on law enforcement and our prosecution of crimes.
So it sounds like, you know, this could very easily and probably already is creating a chilling effect, like people reporting crimes, being willing to assist in prosecution for some of these crimes, especially the more sensitive ones. Would you like recommend a U visa still to someone who's in a good position for one? Or is it just like flag their name to federal immigration enforcement at this point?
That's a really good question. We have first seen a chilling effect. We have had less applicants, and we know that people are afraid to report crimes now. They're not sure which law enforcement will respond and what their response will be. And they're afraid to report trafficking. We're still filing U visas, but we have to have a conversation with people who are choosing to apply, because you are giving your information to the government. And that can be an opportunity for the government because you're giving them your information. Right. And so you need to think about that. And we need to think about the fact that this takes decades. But for some people, this may be their only way to get legal status. And so they may want to choose to proceed with this.
I mean, this comes at a time when we're already seeing, like you said, fear in immigrant communities about reporting crime. I've interviewed several law enforcement officers in the state, you know, saying, please don't let that happen. We will not do any of these enforcement activities in terms of immigration. Call us if there's a crime. Call us if you're a victim of a crime, things like that. I mean, but people are still scared. Do you think this all creates more concerns for public safety at the moment?
Yes, I do. I do, because people aren't reporting crime. And so, like I said, this isn't just interpersonal family violence, although we have a very strong policy reason for wanting to have our legal system intervene to protect victims of domestic violence and child abuse. For nothing else, then there's financial and medical benefits to doing so. But we have strong policy reasons for keeping people safe, for giving people justice, for prosecution and law enforcement to be able to take the really dangerous people off the street. They need witnesses and they need victims to cooperate for that. But with all of the increased enforcement sweeping these people up and causing such fear in the communities, it definitely is going to have a chilling effect on all of our safety and on, you know, our justice system working the way that it should.
All right. We'll leave it there. Kristen Fitzharris is Director of Litigation and Advocacy at Southern Arizona Legal Aid, joining us to talk more about U visas. Kristen, thank you for coming on. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. On the last day of the Arizona State Fair this fall, Jenna Tribus's 12-year-old daughter, Lucy, and her dad went. They rode some rides and visited the petting zoo.
That was on a Sunday. And then on Wednesday, I got a call from her school that she wasn't feeling well. She didn't look well. She just was feeling, had a little bit of nausea and was just really tired and had ended up with a fever that day. So we came home from school, and then the next day she kind of seemed a little bit better, but then kind of the GI issues started and she couldn't keep anything down.
That weekend, Lucy had blood in her stool. So they went first to her primary care physician, who then sent her to the hospital.
We went to the ER Saturday morning, and then it just kind of got worse from there. They were monitoring what we first thought was just for dehydration, right? Because she has now gone days where she couldn't keep anything down. Then we were in the ER for 8 hours. And they said if she still can't, you know, just a sip of water would kind of trigger all the stomach cramping. And so they said, you know, they want to admit her to monitor her. And then a few days later, her blood work started trending in a direction that they didn't like. And it's called HUS. It was her kidney levels. Her kidneys were failing.
HUS, or hemolytic uremic syndrome, is often triggered by the strain of E. coli that Lucy had picked up. Soon, doctors needed to place a catheter in Lucy's neck and start dialysis. Her mom says she was in temporary renal failure, but she says it then got worse from there.
So she had to do 6 cycles of dialysis. She needed 2 blood transfusions. She needed 2 platelet transfusions. She had to be have an NG tube placed down her nose for feeding because she couldn't eat, and that was the only thing she could tolerate.
Jenna Tribus says it took 10 days for her daughter to stabilize before they started seeing any improvement. Lucy spent 18 days in the hospital overall. But her mom says she found out Lucy wasn't the only child there who'd recently been to the state fair, and specifically the petting zoo.
Almost right after we got they did the stool sample and figured out the strain of E. coli that it was. Once we got up into the room, when she was admitted, the doctors almost immediately came in and asked us, you know, like, where have you been recently? And so we discussed that, and they indicated that they are seeing a lot of kids in the hospital at that time with that same strand of E. coli.
At what point did you sense, or did the doctors tell you that things were looking like they were going to be okay for your daughter?
It wasn't. So from the beginning, they did tell us that with this HUS, that it is slow. It is a very slow process. Things get worse, and then they could improve a little and then get worse again. And so that it does take time. So we did know that from the beginning. So they remained positive and hopeful that, you know, everything would be okay. And I personally refrained from looking up any details about HUS just for fear of what that could tell me. But so they said that what she was going through was typical of this bacteria and what it can do.
And is the expectation that she is really going to be okay? Like, she's going to make a full recovery?
They, at this time, are hopeful that, and have no reason to think that she won't make a full recovery. We aren't there yet. They said it could take a year for her kidney function to go back to normal.
Wow.
So we are continuing to do, she has to get blood work regularly. We have to go back to the kidney doctor often. And now we're dealing with, she has high blood pressure from this. So we've started some medication for that, which has kind of caused, she's having some other issues related to that now. So there's still things that we're dealing with, but so we don't know. We don't know because we aren't there yet, but they are hopeful that she will make a full recovery.
How is she doing now? I mean, you're more than a month away from when she first went to the hospital. How's she feeling? How's she doing?
Right. She missed the whole month of November for school. She just went back to school on Monday. She's good. She doesn't have, her energy levels aren't quite there. Her strength isn't quite there yet. You know, her legs, just from walking around, she feels sore just, you know, from being in the hospital bed for so long that it's going to take some time to build her strength back. She still looks, to me, she doesn't look quite right. She's a little pale from, you know, having the blood transfusion. She's, you know, a little bit anemic, but she's good. It's good to see her back with her friends and just back in school and doing normal 12-year-old girl things.
Yeah. How aware is she of what was going on with her?
She was pretty aware. Only so at the hospital, they're really great. They have these child life specialists that come in and will show you diagrams of, you know, things that are going to be done to you and ask you, you know, do you want to know what's going to be happening, what the procedure is? Do you want to know the details? And my daughter did. She wanted to know the details. So, you know, like with the HD catheter, they would show her what that meant and what it looked like. And so she wanted to be informed of all the things that were happening to her along the way. And so she was aware of what was happening. I don't know if she, you know, knew how severe it was or anything like that. But she wanted to know what was wrong with her.
Okay. What kind of communication have you had with health officials or public health officials, anyone like that at the state or county level, to maybe try to piece together what was going on and maybe try to compare your story with those of other families who were in similar situations?
Yeah, I received a call very early on in our stay from the Maricopa County Department of Public Health. She asked me very detailed questions about where Lucy had been, where she'd eaten, where we had been the whole week prior to her getting sick or feeling sick. So I had to provide a lot of detail to them about that. And then I didn't hear anything. And then on the day that she was discharged, I got another call from the same person asking or verifying if Lucy had been to any other petting zoos other than the one at the state fair within that week time period. So that's it. That's what I've heard from them. I haven't received any follow-up or anything.
Did any of the doctors tell you how common or uncommon this particular strain of E. coli is? Like, how rare is it for, you know, a 12-year-old child to end up with what Lucy ended up with?
Yes. So they told us for her to develop, for it to develop into that HUS, the more, you know, the more serious complication from exposure to the E. coli was about 10%, a 10% chance that this could happen.
Jenna Tribus is a mother of two living in Phoenix. We also reached out to the state and county health departments about the story. In a statement, ADHS says it's working closely with the Maricopa County Department of Public Health and other partners to investigate an increase in this kind of E. coli infections. The statement goes on to say that those investigations are concluding and that the parties involved have cooperated fully. ADHS also points out its October report of diseases finds 44 confirmed and probable cases of this strain of E. coli. The Maricopa County Department of Public Health says two full incubation periods have passed with no additional linked cases, which indicates transmission has stopped and there is no ongoing public health risk associated with this outbreak. In a statement, the Arizona State Fair says, "We were made aware of several E. coli cases identified by state and local officials. We are working with them and have provided information to assist with the ongoing investigation. We want to express our concern for the families during this time."
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Driving around parts of the valley, it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. Lights, inflatables, and other decorations are on homes and in yards around town. And it's also not that unusual to spot a truck from one of the companies that install your lights for you on the roads either. With me now to talk about how Phoenicians deck the halls and their roofs and lawns is Craig Outier, editor of Phoenix Magazine. Craig, good morning.
Hey, Mark, how are you doing?
Doing all right. Feeling a little bit festive, I guess. Do you get the sense that Phoenicians or Valley residents go more all out in terms of decorating than do people in other places?
That's a good question. You know, I wasn't something I considered. I mean, it's obviously an enormous thing in the Valley.
Yeah.
And it wasn't something I considered until your excellent executive producer, Amy Silverman, brought it to my attention. You know, maybe it's bigger in the Valley because of our lack of what might be called a season. You know, you look out your window and the winter doesn't look all that different from the summer. I mean, unless you're looking at the mercury, right? I mean, in putting up a you know, self-consciously excessive Christmas light display, I think is one way of maybe we overcompensate maybe for that fact. And, you know, I think there's probably some validity to it. I mean, it's a lot easier to do this kind of Clark Griswold, you know, display here in the Valley than it is in, you know, where you're from, for instance, Connecticut or Chicago, anywhere where there's snow or weather.
Well, it's interesting because growing up in Connecticut, I spent some time in central New York as well, places where it gets very cold and gets a lot of snow. At least at the times I was there, you know, there are some people who would decorate, you know, to the extent that some folks here do. But more often than not, it was maybe, you know, like electric candles in somebody's windows or just nothing at all, as opposed to here where there are maps of the great places to go. It's an activity to go and look at houses that have really gone all out.
I think every major news source in the Valley has done that story. We have, certainly. You can find it online. Yeah, you know, for instance, Brooklyn has a famous neighborhood, Dyker Heights, that goes really overboard, really beautiful old colonial mansions. But I think that's the exception. I think those are special places. And, you know, the Valley has tons of neighborhoods that do that. We did a story on a fellow who grew up loving Christmas floats. So, you know, kind of a twist on the theme. His, you know, he loved Christmas floats and he does his own. He bought a tractor, one of these kind of like, you know, John Deere situations, more like an agricultural tractor, drags his float around. I actually was on my bike with my sister because we have a little, you know, tradition when we do during Christmas. And we found him like in North Central Phoenix near my neighborhood. It was awesome, you know, and I think you find that kind of energy here in the Valley. You know, it is a national thing. It's not just Phoenix, obviously.
Yeah.
And, you know, I hate to give too much cultural import to a Chevy Chase movie, but there is something about Christmas Vacation that created maybe a little divot in our collective psychology about doing these kind of self-consciously over-the-top Christmas displays. It went viral, I think, to some extent, and it continues to because that movie is, you know, it's on cable constantly.
All the time,
So there's something there for sure. And, you know, I did a little deep dive. I found out, you know, I was wondering about the material costs of doing a giant display. Residential electricity has gone down in price, even though it doesn't seem like it has relative to inflation over the decades. So it is cheaper to do these giant displays in terms of the electricity bill relative to inflation. You know, obviously add that as a caveat.
Sure.
And I think the technology's gotten better, too, with the LED lights. I think it's easier to do these kind of like exotic flashing situations than it used to. You don't have to hire a guy from Radio Shack to come out and, you know, wire a circuit board if you want to do that. I mean, really, it's right there. So, yeah.
Does it tend to get you in the holiday spirit to see a bunch of lights on a house or an inflatable Santa on the roof or Frosty the Snowman in the front yard?
I mean, I want to be a Grinch. I don't like the inflatable stuff. It's just a personal, you know, aesthetic choice. I love the lights, you know, I love the kind of, I'm more of like a, you know, the white lights, the kind of, you know, mellow, but I love them. I do love the lights. It definitely puts me in the mood. But I kind of like the, like you were talking about, the more candle-y kind of things.
Okay. We should also point out that this has, like, in some cases, has created controversy. I mean, there have been lawsuits and fights with cities over extensive holiday displays. Like, obviously, we're focused on Phoenix here, but do you get the sense that this sort of thing has also happened elsewhere?
You know, I'm not sure if there's been the kind of friction. I mean, just kind of think about it. If it's your neighborhood, are you always down with it becoming a holiday theme park and the kind of traffic it brings through? You know, that's an interesting point, though, and kind of gets into the whole, association rules, covenants, restrictions, that kind of thing.
HOAs.
And I can't imagine. Yeah, I can't imagine it's localized to the, you know, it completely. It's got to be something other places are dealing with. But I grew up in California and, you know, I left in the 90s and I don't think it was, you know, it's obviously taken off a lot in the intervening decades everywhere, but I don't remember it being nearly as big a deal there.
Okay. So I know this question is kind of like asking a parent to pick their favorite child, but do you have a favorite go-to place that every year you check out for their Christmas decorations?
You know, I haven't developed a personal favorite, but you know, I've heard of one in Gilbert that I'm trying out. And if, you know, if it's any place in the Valley where you'd think they would pull off enormously over the top, grotesquely beautiful residential suburban light displays, it would be Gilbert. So I'm going to look into that one.
All right. We'll have to check back in with you maybe after the holidays, see how you liked it.
Yeah. I will give you a full report.
Awesome. All right. That is Craig Outhier, editor of Phoenix Magazine, talking about holiday light displays, other non-light displays as well across the Valley. Craig, thanks so much. Happy holidays.
You too, and thanks for bringing me on for the serious stuff. I do appreciate that.
Mark, you guys big on the holiday lights at your house?
Not at our house, but we do enjoy going to see other people who have done them.
My kids convinced me to put one inflatable in the yard, and I will draw the line there.
All right.
But we have a whole lot of lights.
We'll check back in with you next year.
More lights every year. Probably more inflatables.
Indeed. Right.
That'll do it for this edition of the show. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show. For Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Anna Hamilton. The show is created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman.